Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben.
And Ben, today's topic is 10 new car technologies that really aren't new at all.
The more things change, huh?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, I mean, it's strange, but all of the stuff that we're going to talk about today, people perceive as being brand new, but we're going to find out that it goes back decades and decades. And I'll tell you how far back it goes as we go through this list. But it comes from an article in Jalopnik. And who is it? Rafael Orlov wrote this article. And well done, by the way. I mean, there's suggestions here from Jalopnik readers. So this is a combination of a question of the day that went out. And they said, what are some new car technologies that really aren't new at all that people think are new? And so I guess when we get to the end of this, I would ask our listeners to maybe contribute some to us that they think are, some that people need to know about. Like, well, that isn't really new. That's been around forever. I mean, I had that on my 1947 Studebaker or whatever.
Right, yeah. So let's just dive right in. What do you say?
Let's do it.
Okay, so number 10. Automatic high beams. And by this, we mean those headlights that will dim when another car comes, the opposite way.
Yeah.
These seem to be super modern, but lo and behold, back in 1952, General Motors debuted this when they called it the Autronic Eye. Autronic Eye. It was a sensor for Oldsmobile, and it could detect when another car was shining its headlights on you and then dimmed your headlights automatically. And you can actually find the brochure for the Autronic Eye out on the internet today.
Autronic Eye. Now, so this is a 62-year-old technology that is still promoted as being revolutionary in automobiles. When you go to the dealership and, you're talking to the salesperson, that's one of the features that they'll point out is automatic, low and high beams, I guess, the automatic dimming,
right,
is what they call it, right?
And,
so again, 62 years old. And, I want to just make one little side note here on this. I find that it's very difficult for me to find anywhere around here that I can use my high beams anymore. And I thought that was strange because I remember, when I was younger growing up, just got my license out on some back roads, I guess, using high beams all the time. You had to.
Yeah.
But now everywhere that I drive now is so congested, so busy with people that it doesn't matter what time of day, where you are, you're unable to use your high beams like you used to.
And because you're a considerate person.
Yeah, you're right. Because a lot of people still use their high beams all day long everywhere, right?
Tell you what, man, we need to fit the Honda with some LEDs. We need to get them always on high and just let it rip.
Well, I've seen people that do exactly that, and it's not very nice. But here's another headlight, I guess, feature that's not brand new that people think is new. And I bet a lot of people point to Tucker when they think about this one, but it goes back farther than that even.
Yep.
All right, so this is swiveling headlights. And now we've talked about Tucker, of course, exhaustively, right? I mean, we had a three-part episode.
Yeah, it was three-parter, wasn't it?
Yeah, three-part Preston Tucker episode, which actually we still get mail about that people really enjoy that story.
Yeah, that highlight in the middle, or the headlight in the middle, excuse me, that lamp, was the one that swiveled with the steering wheel.
Yeah, one central lamp in the center. Now, I had, two normal headlights that didn't do anything, but then the one that would turn, which is kind of like a mechanical situation where, you turn left and the headlight goes left. Makes sense, right?
I mean, I want a Tucker so
it bad. Illuminates exactly where you're going, but that's not exactly where this all began.
Right. Well, the first company actually, well, okay, let's walk backwards, right?
Oh, let's do it in reverse order. How about that?
Yeah,
so, okay, so there's one that's even newer than the Tucker.
Uh-huh.
That a lot of people point to. They think that the Citroen was maybe the first one, right?
Right, with the DS back in the 1960s, but that is not completely correct, Scott.
Well, what's that? Well, let's talk about the DS for just a second, though, because, the Citroen in 1967, it was their Model DS, and this is 47 years ago, so it's a long time, right? I mean, 47 years ago, it was standard on something that they called the Palace model. It was an option on the DS. So, this headlamp would swivel 80 degrees, as the driver steers. So again, it was a mechanical situation. So, the outboard low beam headlamps were also self-leveling on this vehicle. So it did have some, pretty advanced headlight technology or headlamp technology, for its day. I mean, 47 years ago, that's a long time, but even older than that was the Tucker. And that was in 1948. So that was how far ago? That was 66 years ago. But it goes back even farther than that, right?
Yes, you're right, Scott. Even before the Citroen, the first company, or the Tucker, excuse me, the first company to debut this swiveling technology was the Czech Tatra in 1935, a Tatra of all things.
In 1935, from a Czechoslovakian car in 1935, and it had this system, which is pretty incredible. I mean, that's 79 years ago that they were doing this.
Oh, guys, please check out our Cars of the Iron Curtain story.
79 years ago. So 1967, 1948, and then all the way back to 1935, that's when these were supposedly debuted again. Because, you know, it's a technology that came around, it went away. Then it came around again, then it went away. And it's, you know, it's just a cycle thing, a cyclical thing.
So wait, so it sounds like you're more surprised by the time of the invention, by the date of the invention, and I'm more surprised by the automakers who came up with it.
Well, yeah, you know what? And now that I think about it, you're right. I mean, for an Iron Curtain car to really to come up with swiveling headlamps, I mean, that's pretty remarkable, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm not. It's just that they weren't the highest quality cars, but Tatras were the best of breed, right?
I think so. Yeah, definitely.
They were the cars of the party leaders.
Yes, that's right. So out of all of those cars of that that ilk, I guess.
In this enormously equal society, yeah. The only people who could get a Tatra were the ones in charge.
I wonder what the wait list was on that. It was probably like 15 years. So, right. You know, you order one in 1935, you got it in 1950.
Oh, it's rough. I think we did talk about the wait list.
Yeah, we did.
Oh, but one thing we haven't talked about yet in this episode would be retractable hardtops.
Yes. Now, a lot of people think retractable hardtops are something new because I can think of 10 examples right now I could give you of modern vehicles that have retractable hardtops.
And
there's
different kinds, too.
Yeah, Mazda, BMW, Volvo, Chrysler, McLaren. VW, Mercedes-Benz, Infiniti, Mercedes. Did I ever say Mercedes? I did. Ferrari
Mitsubishi.
Has one. Yeah, okay, so there's like 12, 15, something like that. I mean, Ferrari has one even.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty remarkable the number of modern manufacturers that have a retractable hardtop. And a lot of people say, well, that's brand new. And then there's others that say, oh, no, that goes back to the 1950s when I think it was Ford did that first, right?
Yeah.
That's not really true either.
Nope.
It goes even farther back than that. It goes back 80 years.
All the way back to the 1934 Peugeot 601 Eclipse.
Yeah, pretty good name for that vehicle, right? I mean, if you think about it, Eclipse with the top rolling back, right?
Yeah, there's a theme there.
Yeah, pretty smart. So 80 years ago, a 1934 Peugeot, and this is a big vehicle, and it was designed by a guy. He was a legendary French, get this, dentist, war hero, and car designer. His name was Georges Paulin, P-A-U-L-I-N, Paulin. And it's an incredible looking vehicle. I mean, it's really pretty snazzy looking. I mean,
super sleek.
It's a long vehicle with running boards and rolling fenders and everything, but it has this enormous retractable hardtop that went back into the boot area. And it's a cool design. So if you get a chance to take a look at the 1934 Peugeot 601 Eclipse, take a look online and see what you can find because it's really a cool design.
And while you're online, if your Google Foo is good enough, you will be able to see, you'll be able to learn a lot of stuff about number 7 on our list, hybrids. May I rant just momentarily?
Sure.
Okay. So Scott, every so often, increasingly, interest in a specific type or brand of hybrid will hit our show and then we'll say, oh, okay, we'll cover it because we'll read these glowing emails or something from listeners who say this is the future. And then we learn more and more, and we often learn slightly disillusioning things about hybrids, like when we did the cost of ownership for a hybrid versus just an IC car.
Yeah, the equally equipped vehicle with a gasoline engine.
Right. How much money do you actually save? Because so many people will say, you know, well, I'm paying a little extra more now at the upfront, but it's a gold mine in a year.
Yeah, because I'm not going to be buying fuel like you are, like a sucker.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, but then you find out that, you know, it's 17 years before you start making money back at $4 a gallon or whatever it was.
Right. Yeah. There's a heck of an investment there. But despite what many people have told us, the hybrid technology that we think of today is not new by any stretch.
No. You want to guess on how far back this goes, Ben? I think you already know, though. You've been studying, right? So I'll just hit our listeners with this.
All right.
114 years ago was the first hybrid vehicle. 114 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a long time. That's That's longer than General Motors has been in existence. We just talked about GM being a 106-year-old company, right? This is 114 years ago, and it was built by Ferdinand Porsche, but not for his own company, because remember, he was kind of a, he was not a freelancer or anything like that, but he was working for different companies as an automotive engineer in his early days, right?
This was a train car company, right?
I believe it was, and it was, is it Lohner? L-O-H-N-E-R, Lohner. He was working for Lohner at the time. And so this vehicle also, you know, and in addition to being a hybrid, it also had in-wheel motors. I mean, these, you know, motors that power the wheels that are in the wheels. They're built in the wheels. Pretty remarkable for, what year was it, 1900?
Especially considering all the new models, right?
Yeah, there's also new models. I mean, Nissan is even now talking about a vehicle. I think it's called the Blade Glider, Blade Runner.
Blade Glider.
Blade Glider, that real narrow...
It's like a remix of an aerial Atom.
Yeah. It's a crazy vehicle. They're talking about maybe having in-wheel motors in a 2018 Nissan model. So, again, they're talking about this supposed new technology that's not really new at all.
And speaking of that, let's up the stakes a little. Let's raise the ante here.
Sounds good.
All right. Number six. Now, a little bit of a differentiation here. In number six, they call it electric luxury and racing cars. Mm-hmm. I would like to go ahead and just say electric cars.
Okay.
Here's the thing, right? We've got all these electric cars. You'll always hear about them, from the Nissan Leaf to the EV1, right, that Saturn had, and all that slow jazz. And, oh, let us not forget Tesla. But if you go back to the beginning of cars, and longtime listeners, you guys know this, ladies and gentlemen, they're even older than hybrids, of course, because before 1900, most luxury cars were actually electric for a number of tremendously compelling reasons. They were way safer, the ride was smoother, and they were quieter.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it makes sense to think that they would take some of these top-end vehicles and turn them into kind of a race car, I guess. So, you know, the first, land speed record breaking vehicles, right? And it's funny to think about it, because especially taking a look at the photo that goes along with this, because I've got a little bit of information about this specific vehicle, but we're talking about 115 years ago, Ben. That's a long, long time. 115 years ago was the very, very beginning of the automobile era, I guess, in the United States and really around the world. And they're taking these electric vehicles, which, you know, again, they're pretty advanced, actually, for, you know, considering the technology that they had to work with, these lead acid batteries and how heavy they were and the materials that they had to work with and all that, right? So there are people that are taking these and rebodying these vehicles and making them lighter and faster, and they look kind of ridiculous. There's a funny one here that goes along with this article, and it's actually the very first vehicle to reach 100 kilometers per hour, which is about 62 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. And that was extremely fast in 1899. You got to imagine, put yourself in that time,
right? All the suspension is outside of the body of the car.
Yeah, exactly right. It looks like he's sitting on a torpedo.
Yeah.
And the driver is sitting way up high inside that torpedo. Now, that body, Ben, is actually a lightweight, an alloy body, and it was made out of something called partinium. And it's an alloy of aluminum, tungsten, and magnesium that makes up that body. And it's called, and just so our listeners can look this up and kind of see exactly what we're talking about, because it's honestly a pretty ridiculous looking car if you want to think about, like, someone trying to set a land speed record in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Le Jamais Content. And it's a, if you translate that to English, it's a French word. If you translate that to English, it means the never satisfied. So they're saying that, you know, this car can go faster and faster and faster, and it's just a matter of how far we want to push it, really. And if you want to see this vehicle in person, you can actually go see this 1899, you know, luxury electric vehicle that set the land speed record in 1899. You can go see it on display at the Automobile Museum in Compiègne, France, which is in a castle. This museum is in a castle, so that's kind of a cool setting. But what a strange-looking vehicle. I suggest you look it up, because it's really fascinating.
Now, here's one that I think is kind of a softball, number five.
Yeah.
We don't even need to spend too much time on it, because Car Stuff listeners already know that push-button starters are super old. The idea that you could push a button to start the ignition on your car, it's around.
So think about, like, even the, you know, the British sports cars, you know, from the 1930s and 40s that had push button starts. I mean, a lot of them did. I mean, old MGs even had, you know, push button starts. And you know, Aston Martins and, you know, just all the, Jaguars had them. I mean, all these makes and manufacturers from way, way back. I mean, decades and decades ago. I mean, at least 65 plus years ago, they were doing push button starters. And now it's kind of a trend that's come back in the last, I'd say, 7-8 years, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say it's more of a resurgence.
Yeah.
Then there's self-leveling suspension. That makes number four on our list. This is also, I don't know, this is kind of an easy one to me too, Scott, you know?
Yeah, I agree. A lot of manufacturers do this, and they incorporate sometimes self-leveling suspension with self-leveling headlamps and things
sure.
like that that we've already
yeah.
talked about. So, yeah, I mean, but this goes back to 1954. So 60 years ago is when the first self-leveling suspension vehicle, or when you could first get that on a production vehicle, and that was on a Citroen. In 1954, as I said, there was a vehicle called the Traction Avant. But as they say here in the article, the first dramatic use was on the 55 DS. Now, I don't know what they're saying, you know, why they're saying dramatic use. I'm not exactly sure why they would say that. Like, just, you know, to differentiate between the use and dramatic use.
I feel like maybe they're saying the first sustained or publicized well-known use, because usually, you know, it may be very well be a case where the Traction Avant has the capability or...
Or maybe it had a system that didn't work all that great compared to the one that came out in 55.
Yeah,
because
it had an Edsel.
Well, that happens. In 54, it came out and maybe it was a little rough around the edges, but in 55, it was really working well. But anyways, kind of the idea rubbed off on other manufacturers. And, you know, the British Motor Corporation got a similar system that they called Hydroelastic in 1962. And then get this, Rolls-Royce licensed Citroen system in 1965. So they must have been doing something right in the following 10 years, because they got it right after 54 is what I'm saying. Because, you know, between 55 and 65, it was good enough for Rolls-Royce to say, yeah, we'd like that on our car too.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I mean, that's a pretty good promotion for them.
Speaking of something that should be on all cars, regenerative braking is just a great idea,
yeah,
right?
Well,
it's a great idea, and I was caught out by this one, because when I first learned of regenerative braking, this is just so embarrassing. The first time I learned of regenerative braking in a production car was on the Honda Insight.
Ah, I see. So you thought it was brand new.
I was like, wow, that's amazing. Look at the technology. Whoa, we're in the future. But as I was looking into it, you know, because for a time, I kicked around the idea of maybe even getting rid of the Monte Carlo I owned at the time and going for an Insight or a Prius. Didn't take the bait. No regrets yet. But as I was looking into it, I learned that regenerative braking is actually surprisingly old.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, you know, you would think that it would go back to 1900 with Porsche and his inline. I'm sorry, it's in-wheel motors, right?
Right.
You would think, but I'm not even convinced. I'm not sure that one even had regenerative braking. It might have, but I don't see it mentioned anywhere.
No.
This goes back even farther than that. It goes back an additional 6 years. So this is a technology that's 120 years old at this point, Ben. The first car to recharge its battery with the brakes was a vehicle that was built by a guy named Lewis Krieger. And he started building these EVs, I guess you could call them EVs.
Sure.
Back in 1894 in Paris. And it was just, you know, called, I think, the front-wheel drive electric horseless carriage. It was a pretty remarkable vehicle. It looks just like a horse, you know, a carriage that would have a horse out front.
It does.
But it has a couple of chauffeurs on the front with the steering wheel. And it's kind of like a, it does have a steering wheel, but it's in a flat position, almost like you would see a rudder, you know, those rudder drive vehicles.
And it's got asymmetrical wheels.
Yeah, that's a strange look, isn't it? I mean, I think there were batteries stored in different places, like under the driver's was one, under the coach was a second battery, and this thing would charge in different regenerative braking modes, and there were more than one.
Yeah, there were eight. There was one just for starting, right? There was one for slow speed forward, three for recuperation at 40 volts, four and five were normal speeds, six was recuperation at 80 volts. Seven and eight were recuperation at extra high speeds. These were all ways of charging the battery.
So you have a car in 1894 that's electric that is
eight modes.
With eight regenerative braking modes, which is pretty remarkable. I mean, think about 1894, the technology that they had available and what they were doing with it. I mean, they're pretty smart about how they did this. The technology then was used later on in some early tram cars, I found out. So the idea was that, you know, tram cars around, you know, turn of the century, around 1903, they started to use regenerative braking to charge batteries and to slow cars down on steep grades. But I guess there was a serious accident that put an embargo on that type of traction somewhere around 1911. There was some kind of a major mishap that happened with it. And they determined that, you know, maybe that was at fault, maybe it wasn't, but we're going to put an embargo on this type of technology for now just because we're not sure. But 20 years later, it made a comeback. And around 1931, the idea of regenerative braking for tram cars was, you know, beginning to be used again. Mm-hmm. But then we didn't hear about it really until, well, again, it was like probably mid-2000s, right? I mean, when you heard about it, like mid, what, like 2005, 4, whenever. I don't know if I even want to put a date on it because I can't remember when all these vehicles were coming out with the supposed new technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But a lot of people were like me and just stupidly amazed by it without, you know, I mean, that's not fair. I was stupidly amazed. Other people were probably just legitimately amazed.
But think about it this way. I mean, over your lifetime, the course of your lifetime, there was no real need for you to know that unless you were an antique collector of some kind or had studied the history of tram cars or you knew about, you know, the specific Krieger vehicle that used regenerative braking. I mean, we just didn't have any real need to know about that until it came about again.
Well, you're very kind. You're very kind. Here's one thing that might have caught a lot of other people by surprise. Let's start as we get to, let's see, what is this? This is number two on our list. So let's explore this a different way.
Okay.
This technology also comes from the late 1800s, but a lot of people think it's new.
Yeah, it does. And this is an interesting one because it was a big deal when I worked at Chrysler because they were coming out with vehicles that were powered or that the power was transferred to the wheels via CVT. Now, that's continuously variable transmission. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a pretty big fascination with this type of technology because it is interesting how it works. And I think we've either done a podcast or an article on this on our site, I'm sure.
Yeah, we've done transmissions and we covered CVT in both on the website, howstuffworks.com, shameless plug, and on our podcast, which you can hear on carstuffshow.com, shameless plug number two.
Yep, very good, Ben. And you know what? This is one, though, that I will say is primarily visual. I mean, you really have to see this in operation to understand, and you have to study it. You have to see what's going on, and then it has to be labeled, really, to show you, like, watch right here, and this is what's happening. And it'll tell you, you know, the annotations, I guess, have to be turned on your video in order to understand.
Why they call it the rubber band drive, right?
Exactly right. And the one that I'm thinking of used a chain. So, you know, there's different modes what they called a belt. I think it was a metal belt.
Yeah.
But there's different ways to do this, and it came from a very unlikely source, right?
Yeah, it came from a sawmill, right?
Yeah, this is so strange. The first car to have a CVT was built by a guy named Milton Reeves back in 1896, which, again, that's 118 years ago. And that idea was derived from his sawmill transmission, which was invented in 1879. So the idea of the CVT goes back to 1879, and it was first used for a sawmill transmission. And I can't even say that was the first use because that's just where he got the idea from.
Right, yeah.
It could have come from anywhere else. And they could say, well, that sawmill in 1879, that idea came from this, you know, 20 years prior. I don't know. I'm not sure where that came from, but we can trace it back as far as 1879.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, we have arrived at the number one spot on this list, which we actually mentioned in a tangent earlier in this podcast. Mr. Benjamin, would you like to do the honors?
I will, Ben, and I'll tell you that Tesla Motors is not the first company to pose this idea. Battery swapping.
Yep. He is not the first by a long shot.
Yeah, so we're talking about Elon Musk, right? Uh-huh. And his great idea that's brand new, right, to swap batteries in cars as you drive across the country. So, you know, you deplete your battery, you pull into a charging station, and you've either got the option of plugging in and hanging around for a few hours until it charges back up, or they can unbolt the one that you've got in your vehicle and bolt in a brand new one, and you're on your way.
So back in the 1880s, New York City had this company named, in a burst of wild creativity, the Electric Vehicle Company. And the Electric Vehicle Company had a fleet of electric taxi cabs, and you would just If you were driving the cab, you would drive around until you were running low on power. You would go to the EVC headquarters, and they would have a warehouse full of batteries. And then the taxi would drive on this little platform, and some guy would come out and switch it out, you know, pit stop style.
Yep, that's right. Quick, right?
Yeah. And the problem was that they spent so much money keeping their own battery swap technology growing, just the battery technology, that the cabs grew too old and expensive.
Again, and I've got to say this again, and we keep saying this, right? We keep saying that we got to remember that electric cars were mainstream up until about 1900.
Which is so very strange.
Yeah. I mean, right around 1900. So, you know, we talked about 1880s here all the way through. Mm-hmm. When did the company finally go under?
It was 1907.
1907, the company finally went bankrupt. And they were operating some crazy amount of electric vehicles within New York City. They were operating, I want to say they grew. He also expanded too fast, and that was one of the problems.
Yeah, so, that happens a lot.
So, you know, there's this guy, and I'll just give you kind of a tiny little backstory, and then we'll move on from
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
But so we're already at number one, so we don't have anywhere to go from this one. This an interesting little side note on the electric car company, right?
Mm-hmm.
And why it kind of failed early on. And I think that most of it points to this one guy and this one company, which is pretty interesting. I'm almost thinking that we should do a full episode on this, but I'll briefly outline it here. How about
that? Okay, yeah, do the Reader's Digest first.
Yeah, I will. In 1900, there were more electric automobiles on New York City streets than there were cars powered by gasoline at the time. So, you know, proportionally, there were more electric vehicles in 1900 than there were gas-powered vehicles.
Hmm.
Although I should say that there were more steam-powered vehicles than any other type of vehicle on the road at that time.
I mean, so, to be fair.
Yeah, exactly. So there's this guy, he was the former Secretary of the Navy. His name is William C. Whitney, and he kind of bought up this company that was running short on cash. It was a New York City electric cab company that was run by two guys named Morris and Solomon, and they had something like $200 million in assets at the time when he bought them. And I don't know what he bought them for, but must have been low. And he had dreamed that he was going to build this kind of taxi cab empire, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this Whitney guy did. And so he thought, well, I've got a solution for the obstacle that these battery-powered electric vehicles have. Instead of stopping every couple hours to recharge as they had in the past, he was going to do this battery swap thing, right?
So yeah.
All this sounded familiar.
Yeah.
So he does all this, right? And he actually gets the stations in place, and it's all working out fine. And he starts to grow. He starts to expand, but he expands too fast. And honestly, Ben, now that I think about it, that idea of swapping the battery, it kind of goes back to the early, early days of these taxis or these runabouts where they would have, and I don't know if runabout's the right word, but they would swap horses. So you get the driver would come in and get a fresh horse.
Yep,
and
that's
then,
true.
And then go out for another round.
Pony Express did that too.
Yeah. So there you go. That's your battery swap origin right there. Now that I think about it. All right, so he expanded too fast. They went from something like 13 cabs when he started,
mm-hmm.
then they expanded to like 200 cabs, and then to 1600 cabs. So, you know, it was too fast and
furious.
It was
sorry. sorry.
Yeah, that's right. And he ended up with like something like 2000 battery operated taxis that are operating in the city, trucks, buses, things mm-hmm. like that are going around, right? And he's really focused on that battery swap system and how that's all working and the technology to keep that going. And the cabs just went into kind of disrepair. They just weren't being maintained the way they should have been. And they were a safety concern mm-hmm. and it just led to the downfall. And then people got such a sour taste in their mouth from that experience because they saw these cars that just rapidly deteriorated. And their impression later on was that, well, these electric cars, they're kind of junk. But that's
Ouch.
Not really the yeah. case.
Nobody wants to ride in a ratty cab.
There were decades of cars before that were perfectly fine, that were maintained and you know worked well and everything worked out fine. But they remember these taxi cabs in New York that were so poorly run and so poorly operated that it left this bad taste in their mouth. And really, that was so hard to overcome that it's been decades and decades and decades before people kind of forgot about all that. And they're saying, well, maybe electric's the way to go again.
Well, that's part of the, you know, I think that's part of the problem, but that was not the only thing that happened. And you know that some of the shades of one of my other shows are coming out
yeah.
whenever we talk about what happened to electric cars
sure.
around that time period. And we actually covered this in car stuff as well. But without harping on that, I will say that there are a couple of other technologies that we found along the way that are often reported as new that are not actually new, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like you probably stumbled upon a few.
Well, like what?
Well, hydraulic suspension, but
sure.
That goes to that self-leveling suspension too. That was mm-hmm. one. Reverse cameras.
Oh, yes, reverse cameras.
We looked at that with some of the concept cars. I think there was a Motorama car that had that, wasn't there?
I think there was. Yeah, that's right. One of the ones that the Dream
was
car
it the Buick Centurion?
It might have been the Centurion. It was, that sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a car from, you know, like, when was it, the 50s?
Yeah.
1950s?
Yeah, it's one of the
so
Harley Earl cars.
Yeah, it's like a 60-plus-year-old vehicle that had a rear backup camera system
mm-hmm.
and, you know, a PA system and all kinds of crazy stuff. So all this stuff that, you know, people think is brand new, if you really do some digging, the idea or the actual piece itself may go back. I mean, in some cases, like, you know, the battery swapping thing,
predates cars.
It's 125 years old.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is 125 years mm-hmm. old, and Elon Musk is going to be filthy rich from this idea right here in the modern day.
Well, and it's interesting too, because whenever you hear about a new innovative feature, there's a good chance that you can find a precedent in what I call some of the anachronistic cars, by which I just mean, that they were probably ahead of their time.
Mm-hmm.
So like the Phantom Corsair has a lot of stuff that shows up later.
Right? Sure. Yeah. But it's just features. It's not the overall car. The overall car was, I guess, in a way, a failure, right? I mean,
it's absolutely
awesome. It's really a great car.
The features are good. The ideas are good. Just like the Tucker 48.
Yeah.
Good car, right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that these features alone, depending upon the time in which they come out, may not be what the market wants, especially if they are expensive.
Oh, yeah. That's always the thing, is the new technology is always expensive. So when you initially see this stuff,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be expensive. But when it comes back, it's going to be refined and maybe a little bit lower cost, right?
Yeah.
Well, hopefully. But, you know, we still are seeing that hybrid cars were still more expensive. I mean, which is weird because hybrid cars have been around since 1900, as we found out. But you would think that by 2005 or whenever the Prius came out, that you would think that, you know, maybe it would be a little bit lower cost. But they're not using technology from 1900. They're using
right.
new technology to put it together. It's a new way to do it. So, it's going to be more expensive initially, and it's going to slowly start to come down as, you know, the years pass.
But Scott, lists like these have me always shaking my fist at the sky and wondering what would have happened. Where would we be now if this stuff had not gone away mm-hmm. and returned, if it had just continually been researched upon? I mean, there's nothing we can do about it.
No.
We can't change the past.
Yeah,
but
look at it, you know, 2020 hindsight, right? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it's difficult to determine where we would be now. I mean, would we have flying cars? Would we have, you know, the Jetson-type future that they thought we were going to have?
Oh, there's some news about flying cars recently.
Oh, no. Oh, boy. Okay.
We'll save it for another day.
Okay. Maybe for a Nuts and Bolts episode.
Maybe for a Nuts and Bolts episode. And we would like for you to participate in this show, if you're game. Write an email to us or hip us to something that you'd like other Car Stuff listeners to know about. We may read your email, tweet, or Facebook message on the air. The only way we can do that, of course, is if you send it to us. So hit us up on the internet. We are CarStuffHSW. We're CarStuffShow.com. And if you want to email us directly, if you don't like the whole social media rigmarole, we get it. Our address is
CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.